This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I am Major Garrett, the host of the Takeout Podcast. Welcome to episode 17, the happy sound you hear around us. Restaurant 701 in the Penn Quarter of Washington, D.C. And do we have a special guest for you this week? Our very first sitting United States Senator. I told you on this podcast, as we evolve, as we develop, the guests are going to keep ringing louder and louder bells in terms of news, significance, and value. We have the biggest, loudest bell ringer we have ever had in the 17th episode of the Takeout Podcast. Wouldn't you agree, Steve Shigaris, political director of CBS and world's greatest podcast sidekick?
Hello, Major.
Wouldn't you
agree? I completely agree.
But who is it? You keep wondering. Who is it? Say the name. Say the name, Major. I'm going to say the name. Amy Klobuchar.
Well,
Senator,
thank you.
From the great state of Minnesota, welcome to the Takeout Podcast microphone. Thank you for joining us. Boy, do we have a lot to talk about this week.
We do, and I am a sitting senator, but I am actually sitting with you.
Sitting with you, exactly. We have a double sitting.
I got a little wine while I was waiting for you, you know, woman drinking alone, waiting for you to come to do the podcast. So it's been.
I guarantee you, you're the first woman ever drinking alone, waiting for me. I guarantee you that.
Okay, but I needed.
It's usually the other way around.
It's usually me
after my week
and waiting and waiting and waiting.
Precisely. Okay. Let's just get some foundational questions to you, Senator.
Okay.
This is a very big week in Washington with lots of terminology that sounds kind of frightening to some Americans being bandied about. So, do you believe President Trump's decision to fire the FBI director, James Comey, creates, as one of your colleagues, Richard Blumenthal, suggested earlier this week, a constitutional crisis for this country?
Well, I think it could well do that.
Has not yet, but could.
Exactly. And in several ways. So, first of all, Jim Comey, I have to put this out here. Jim Comey was my law school classmate. He was well-respected by...
University of Chicago?
University of... Okay, I guess you did your research. 1985, class of 1985, and we worked together on the law review, and that was... I put that in there to sound, you know, really smart.
Very smart.
And he was well-respected by everyone in our class, just as he is from the FBI agents that he managed for 3 years and by a lot of law enforcement in my state. So this was quite a shock. Now, I was very clear this year. I didn't agree with what he did on the Hillary Clinton email investigation by any means. But that doesn't mean you fire someone, especially not 6 months later. And I am I was stunned that they did this the same week, sandwiched in between Sally Yates' testimony, which was pretty devastating to the administration. And then he was supposed to testify this week about Russia, among other things, and then they had the audacity to fire him. It was pretty surprising in the middle of a major, major investigation involving the Trump campaign in Russia.
You mentioned Sally Yates. For our audience, she was the acting attorney general for a very brief period of time. She was fired by President Trump. The White House asserted because she would not fulfill her obligation, according to the White House, to enforce the first version of the travel ban executive order. But she appeared before the Judiciary Committee on the Senate side this week. You had a question and answer session with her, as did many other senators. I want to play one of those sound bites, sound bite number one, about an exchange you had with Sally Yates. Let's listen to that now.
Do you have any doubt that the information that you conveyed to the White House on January 26 should have been made clear that Flynn had been potentially compromised by Russia, that this information was clear?
Well, the purpose... in our telling them, again, was so that they could act and so that they could convey that information. So I would hope that they did.
If a high-ranking national security official is caught on tape with a foreign official saying one thing in private and then caught in public saying another thing to the vice president, is that material for blackmail?
Certainly.
This is all about Michael Flynn, the very short-lived national security advisor for President Trump, the shortest tenure in American history for a national security advisor. That's one aspect of the Russia story. James Comey and the confirmed counterintelligence investigation is another part of the story. One other thing that came up during that hearing was James Clapper, the former director of the Office of National Intelligence, was asked do you have evidence of collusion? He said no. Then he was asked, are you aware of this FBI counterintelligence investigation? No, I am not. Therefore, I can't give you an updated declaration that no collusion occurred. And then the next day, the FBI director who is overseeing that investigation is fired. Some see this as more than a coincidence. Do you believe those dots can and should be connected, or do you think it is possible they could be coincidental?
I really don't think it's coincidental when you look at every step of the way here. How about just about a month ago or so when the president tweeted out at 6 in the morning that President Obama was wiretapping the Trump Tower? Who was the one that then went testified and said that that wasn't true? That would be Jim Comey, the FBI director. Then you have him involved in this investigation, reports coming out that he's been asking for more resources for the investigation, which would argue that he was ramping it up. And then he gets fired. And the problem was the memo that the president attached to his letter firing him really was had a lot of statements from the political campaign, from people who had been in law enforcement, criticizing Director Comey's conduct during the Hillary Clinton investigation, but it didn't seem like a normal memo to me. And then, lo and behold, we also find out that the president had been thinking of firing him for a long period of time. So the argument that we first heard is, hey, the Justice Department came up with this new memo and that says he should be fired. It really doesn't bear out when you hear that the president was thinking of firing him for a long period of time. All of this leads me to believe that we need a special prosecutor to look into everything. When you fired the acting attorney general, the attorney general of the United States is recused because of his dealings with Russia, and you have now fired the FBI director. I would say this is a problem for the integrity of our criminal justice system and our country. We are a country where our ideal is democracy. We're not all one ethnic group. We're all not one religious group. We are a democracy, and that a democracy is under assault, and we protect it by getting to the bottom of this.
So the call for a special prosecutor, the question I have on that person's going to have to answer to the Attorney General and the President, correct? I mean, they will have the opportunity to get rid of that person if they need to, or no? I mean, how would you set that up?
Okay, so under this law, it allows the Justice Department to, the Attorney General can pick a special prosecutor. However, it actually says when the Attorney General is recused, the Deputy Attorney General would choose a special prosecutor. So in this case, that would be Rod Rosenstein, who wrote the memo. But I think you could argue that if enough pressure is put on to make sure it's someone who is apolitical, who is someone that both sides of the aisle admire, that we would be in a better place than where we are now.
And doesn't that really, as an organic matter, Senator, redound to Republicans going to the White House and saying, we're no longer comfortable with this, and the Justice Department has to seriously consider that which it has not considered previously?
Yes, I hope that my Republican colleagues step up to the plate. A few of them have made statements, everything from John McCain saying that he was disappointed to Richard Burr, who has access to all of this information as the head of
the Senate Intelligence Committee,
saying that, you know, here's a Republican from North Carolina saying that he's troubled, that the timing didn't make sense. And then finally, Jeff Flake said he had thought for hours, a senator, Republican senator from Arizona, had thought about this for hours and hours and could not come up with the rationale for the timing. I just think this is a problem, and the Republicans are going to have to work with us to protect our democracy because, as Marco Rubio said, this time it was one party. The next time it's going to be another.
So your answer to the question of whether you think this is a constitutional crisis was pretty tempered, but some of your colleagues have been not only fanning the flames of constitutional crisis, but they've been using the terms Nixonian. They've been repeating Saturday Night Massacre.
Well,
my question to you is, what do you say to your colleagues? Are they over-politicizing this?
I think they are just so appalled by what happened. And they are simply trying to call attention to the American people to know this is not business as usual. And there is an interesting analogy here. Now, and you could even argue that what Nixon did when he fired the special prosecutor, it was already a special prosecutor, and then we got a new special prosecutor. We don't even have a special prosecutor. He has simply fired the former acting head of the Justice Department, the Sally Yates, and then fired the FBI director. And so the reason my colleagues are saying it, I would say it could be a constitutional crisis, is if you start having no FBI director and you've got no way to investigate what is an obvious crime that needs to be investigated, you got to get to work on it.
Before you were a United States Senator, you were Hennepin County prosecutor. Did that for 8 years. So you know how to prosecute cases. You are someone professionally trained to gather evidence and ask questions. So let me put this to you. If you were a prosecutor in this matter, what kind of evidence would you seek, and what kind of questions would you demand to be answered?
Well, first of all, we would like to know what Trump campaign officials had contact with the Russian government. And you'd want to go through each one of them and figure it out, and maybe you get someone to testify about it. Obviously, you would want to know if the candidate, now the president, had any involvement in this. You would want to know why they were doing this. It's sort of the old classic, where, what, how, and mostly what I would like to know is why. What motivated them to do this? But now the waiter's here.
The waiter is hovering. It's the dinner hour. We're going to put our order in. I looked at the menu online, so I know exactly what I want. Beef tenderloin off the dinner menu. And foodies, be prepared to slap your forehead in exasperation and disgust. Medium plus, if I could, please.
You with the medium plus again, Major.
Always,
you
know, with the medium
plus.
That's a
good Midwestern thing to do.
Very Midwestern.
You know what I think? I think I figured it out. I think that's something they do with the palm.
And then when you have
we're not mentioning the palm here.
Go when ahead. You have people on from California, do you just like order things rare or something? Okay, I'm going to have the bass. It's not as good as walleye from Minnesota, I bet.
Nothing is.
I'll get that.
And Steve?
Okay. And Fari, I'll have the beef tenderloin as well. Medium. No medium plus for me, just medium. Thank you.
All right. Our dinner order is in. It will be delivered shortly. We are joined by Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, a Democrat. I'm Major Garrett, joined by Steve Shigaris, political director of CBS, the greatest podcast sidekick
my favorite
in this
part of the week,
or
by
any
the way.
Other world. As you know, dear listeners, new episodes of this podcast, you know it, it's called The Takeout, are available every Friday morning. We invite you, I mean, we really invite you to subscribe, rate, and comment on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. And you can also now, we are happy to tell you, find us on Spotify.
Oh,
go to takeoutpodcast.com, follow us, and like us on Instagram, Facebook, not Faceback. That was a Belichick. Yeah, that was a Belichick thing.
FaceTime.
Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. That's at Takeout Podcast. I'm Major Garrett. Thanks for joining us for episode 17. We'll be back in a second.
You're listening to The Takeout.
Welcome to The Takeout. I'm Major Garrett, joined by Steve Shigaris. For those of you watching on CBSN, God love you. Here is The Takeout sticker, world famous, with the completely illegible signature of yours truly, Major Garrett. There is only one way, dear listeners, you can acquire said sticker. And Senator Klobuchar, I know you'll be fascinated by the... Well, you get one because you're a guest. You get to take that home.
Wow.
You have to send us a self-addressed stamped envelope. Very old school. Very 70s.
Please don't forget to include that.
Yes.
We've gotten a couple letters that have forgotten the stamp or has forgotten the envelope.
And then you just disregard them?
Well, we try our best. But we have a mailbag now, an actual real-life mailbag.
I'll bring the mailbag next week, I promise.
And Steve Shigaris is going to update our loyal audience about how many people have participated in this very old-school methodology of obtaining a Takeout Podcast sticker.
Steve? I just want to briefly mention that I thought this was just a goofy little thing, and now we've had 84 people write in from 29 states in the District of Columbia.
When Steve and I started this, we thought maybe three people.
Right.
The whole country
no one's listening,
would do
right?
this. Right.
Six from Minnesota, which is pretty good. California, number one, with 11.
My
so,
home state.
Anyway.
Well, of course, proportionally,
keep the cards.
The most populous state in the union. Yeah. Let's not forget
29
that.
States, that means there are 21 of you who have not sent your self-addressed stamped envelope. And so I'm going to call out a state, and I hope to get a letter from Nebraska. This week. I haven't
there
seen anything
go.
From Nebraska. Anyway.
Well, you know, they have more people in there for their college football games in their when they
in Lincoln.
Right,
yes.
In Lincoln than they do in any of the towns at any other time.
Exactly.
Really?
So it might be hard.
And just as an aside, since the senator brought it up, if you ever get a chance to go to a football game in Lincoln,
It's a terrific experience. Uh-huh. They are the nicest people I've ever met in this country. I went there to see UCLA play. The UCLA beat Nebraska. At the end of the game, I'm wearing all sorts of UCLA regalia. I'm a University of Missouri grad, but I was there supporting now my wife, who's a UCLA grad. And they, after the game, said, thanks for coming to Lincoln. Travel safely home. Good game. And the first person who said that to me, I thought there was some sort of secret camera, and this was like just to punk me to see what I would do.
They
and
want
then
you
after
to
the
come
12th
back.
Person said that, I'm like, this is a thing. There's this actual organic niceness in Lincoln, Nebraska. So,
all those nice words for Nebraska.
Exactly.
Now,
so send us a self-addressed stamped envelope request.
Here's how to do this, by the way. Right. If you would like your very own Takeout Podcast sticker signed by a major, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
And do you have some mail that you would like to share
with
us?
We'll do the mail in our Takeout Outtake Especial.
Back to the Senate, because
there
we are
a lot
so
of rules here.
A lot of
okay,
rules.
Okay.
So many. Not as many as the Senate floor, though.
Okay, good.
Okay?
Okay.
The Senate Democrats gathered today to talk about their collective reaction to the James Comey firing. And as I understand it, I was at the White House doing lots of other different things. One or two committee hearings had to be postponed because there wasn't consent. Has this created a watershed moment in the way Senate Democrats look at just the overall daily procedures of the Senate to raise this issue to the level of, we may not only just disagree, we may use procedural means to slow down the Senate as an act of protest?
Well, as of today, I don't think we can say that at all for sure, because our first instinct, and I can tell you this was discussed behind closed doors, was to work with the Republicans on this. We've noticed that a number of them have said things that they want to work together and get to the bottom of what happened here. We have had a few of them, including one that talked to me, who's even suggested we need to get an FBI director that has strong bipartisan support. We cannot have a 51-vote situation here for the FBI director. As someone, we used to be in law enforcement, you know, you don't really, people who go to work every day and put their lives on the line don't really want to think about the politics of if something's Democratic or Republican. So I think we owe it to that agency, and we owe it to law enforcement to do that. And so there's been a lot of discussions, and I'm hopeful that we wouldn't have to get to that point because we'll be able to work together.
What do you advocate for within your own caucus on this?
Okay. I advocate for, one, trying to work together because with this Russian inquiry, this is an assault on our democracy, not on one party. I think we should get a special prosecutor, and I also think we should have an independent commission. On January 4th, after I got back from Ukraine, Georgia, and the Baltics with John McCain and Lindsey Graham, I did an event with two House members and another senator and said we need an independent commission. And by the way, you haven't spent a New Year's Eve until you spend one on the Ukrainian front line with John McCain and Lindsey Graham, where President Poroshenko, to show Americans' friendship with Ukraine and American might, with the snow coming at us, freezing cold weather on the sea, gives John McCain on live TV a machine gun, gives Lindsey...
Who does?
President Poroshenko. The three of us are standing out there with the troops around us. Gives John McCain a machine gun, Lindsey Graham a pistol, and me two daggers. That really happened. Then...
What have you done with the daggers since then? Are you keeping them in reserve?
It's been confiscated by the Navy. We've never seen him. McCain keeps going, where's my machine gun? So, yeah. But the
I can understand him actually asking that. Like walking down the quarters, where's my machine gun?
That's exactly right. But what we saw on that trip was that these countries have been through this before. Estonia, you know, moving a statue, they get their internet service cut off. Or Lithuania invites some members of parliament from the Ukraine. And so what happens to them that from Ukraine? They get... their members of parliament get hacked into. It's
by
really,
Russia.
By Russia. They have seen this movie before. And so we need to have our citizens educated so that they understand what's going on, because other countries have been through this for decades.
And this is a chilling thing, it sounds like, what you're
it
saying.
It is. Well, in addition to 10,000 people killed in Ukraine because of the illegal invasion and annexation of Crimea.
You talk about bipartisanship around the FBI director, the next FBI director. I think that's probably music to a lot of people's ears who might be listening to this, given the hyper-polarization I think that we've seen at least in the last 6 months or so. Are you concerned, though, that there are people on your side of the aisle, on the Democratic side of the aisle, that just are of the mindset that no matter what Trump does, we are going to be against it? And we've seen, I think, a lot of that over the last 100 days plus. Is that a concern of yours?
Not really, because in every case, you'll have like General Mattis that came before us, and that was a near unanimous vote. You have the head of the Veterans Administration, near unanimous vote. You had a number of people like that that came.
Not the Supreme Court nominee.
No, but there were a number of people where there are people on the Twitter feed that say vote against every single person that's ever met with Donald Trump, practically. And I figure we have an obligation in the Senate. It's a place of compromise, but we're also an emergency break. And for me, especially in the national security area, I want to have some professional people with expertise, whether they would have been my first choice or not, who are running those agencies. And there's a number of Democrats that feel the same way, and certainly we feel the same way about the FBI.
I'm glad Steve brought up the Supreme Court. Let me just ask you this. So the American Bar Association, hardly part of the supplementary ideological wing of the Trump White House. Okay, I think we can safely say the American Bar Association is not.
Well, actually, they have now said they don't want to listen to their recommendations. I hope the Congress still will.
Right, and that's my point, because the American Bar Association gave Judge Neil Gorsuch, well qualified, the highest rating it can provide for anyone. When Democratic nominees submitted by Democratic presidents for the Supreme Court have received that ABA rating of well qualified, lots of Republicans voted for them. Say, I don't agree with them.
Oh, not lots. I mean, well, it was with Sotomayor and Kagan, right?
Enough to avoid a filibuster.
Yeah. But I mean, those are two examples where they said ideologically I'm not there, mm-hmm. but the qualifications are there, mm-hmm. and yet that was not the Gorsuch experience.
Well, there were some Democrats that voted for Gorsuch. I think what happened with Gorsuch is that, number one, you know, for a whole year they stalled out on Merrick Garland. That was a very big deal. Number two, there were some Democrats that voted for him, and there was a real attempt to try to see if there could have been some agreement where we would have kept 60 votes for Gorsuch, which means that we would have had 60 votes for Gorsuch, as long as they said, well, for the next nominee, we're going to do the same. We're not just going to blow through the filibuster and go down to 51.
And they wouldn't guarantee you for that next pick that would be likely to shift the ideological balance of the court.
I saw the papers and no one could get that agreement. Now, here's the silver lining. The day of the Gorsuch vote, when people were predicting the demise of the Senate that I never believed, actually, 61 of us, led by Susan Collins, signed a letter that said we would keep in the 60 votes, keep in debate for legislation, which means we preserve the bulk of the compromising part of the Senate where we actually work together to craft legislation.
Where minority rights are respected, number one, and
completely.
They become a fulcrum toward some dimension of compromise. It's not a compromise that's going to solve everyone's problems or address everyone's issues, but 60 is better than 51.
That would be right.
Okay. Steve?
I need to wrap this.
Are you telling me to wrap this segment? I just got the wrap from...
Sorry, I was giving you a
so
time.
So we can get to, like, fun questions.
Yeah, we will get to fun questions.
Is this too hard?
No, I like it, but it was like a podcast over meal, and I can't... I know, that happens when we get our food.
When we get our food, exactly.
Yeah. I get it.
Which we have ordered, and we'll be on our way. But
no,
when Steve Shigaris gives you the wrap signal, you've got a wrap. So when we come back, we're going to talk about health care, tax reform, and some fun stuff.
I'm all ready to go.
And some fun stuff. You are listening to The Takeout.
As far as I'm concerned, your premiums, they're going to start to come down. We're going to get this passed through the Senate. I feel so confident. Your deductibles, when it comes to deductibles, they were so ridiculous that nobody got to use their current plan.
That's the recognizable voice of the 45th President of the United States, Donald John Trump, talking about the House passage of a Obamacare repeal and replace piece of legislation that's now in the United States Senate. I said at the time when the president had his Rose Garden ceremony with House Republicans celebrating the passage in that chamber, when he said deductibles will come down, premiums will come down, everyone in American politics will hold on to that soundbite, Democrats and Republicans. Senator Klobuchar, where do you think the health care debate is heading in the Senate? And if you were to bet now, do you think anything actually emerges from the Senate, or has this legislation come there to be delivered an unceremonious burial?
Well, first of all, I was pretty surprised that the House passed that bill. I am the first one, the day we passed the Affordable Care Act, while I really embraced the pre-existing condition ban and all the good things we did in there, I said it's a beginning and not an end. Maybe it's because I'm a state that has everything from the Mayo Clinic to a lot of good healthcare systems and a lot of doctors.
And a lot of medical device companies.
Yes, but I always thought there should be some changes. That was one of them.
One big one, absolutely. Right. The medical device tax
but
is a huge issue.
But for me, the big change that was not in that House bill at all was reducing prescription drug prices. They're now 20% of our healthcare costs. I've got the bill for Medicare Part D negotiation. McCain and I have a bill for bringing in less expensive drugs from Canada. Chuck Grassley from Iowa and I have a bill to make it easier for generics to come in the market. None of that's in that House bill, so that's my number one focus. All of the arguments that can be made, we don't have a cost analysis. We don't know, which is unbelievable. We don't know how many people are going to be kicked off their plans because of pre-existing conditions. So this is a big problem. I was surprised. I did the high-five celebration chest-thumping moment out in the Rose Garden. Because I think there's so much work to do. And then the sobering words came, a lot less high fives from Republicans in the Senate. You already had Rand Paul over there with his copy machine trying to get a copy of it. You had Rob Portman talking about the Medicaid issues with the bill, Susan Collins, the Planned Parenthood issues. And I don't think anyone in the Senate on the Republican side has completely embraced this bill. So what I'm hoping the Senate does is take the Affordable Care Act, and I know they have this group of guys working on their own version, but in the end, we are going to need to have a bill that actually works for America. And I think the best thing to do is take the Affordable Care Act, and our caucus is pretty united on this, and make some positive changes. Make it easier to afford the exchanges, the delivery system reform, doing something more on prescription drugs.
On prescription drugs, I listened, because I attended, as these listeners to this podcast know, more than 75 Trump rallies across the country in my coverage of this campaign. I heard him talk about prescription drug prices extensively. During the campaign, he said he wanted to bring them down, break pharma's stranglehold on this process, and find alternative ways. Do you believe him now that he's president, and has there been any outreach of any kind from the White House to you on this subject?
Well, for the sake of American people, I hope that he will do this. And I've got a, if there is any chance he'll support my bill, which is has a lot of co-sponsors on there, that would be great on the Medicare Part D negotiation.
Have you called?
And some of the other things. I have been over to the executive office building, and Jared was there and met with Chris Christie, where we talked about prescription drugs in the context of opioids. And it was a meeting on opioids. But I remember I said, because I had liked a quote that Governor Christie had once given in a acceptance speech, where he said that you go not just where it's comfortable, but where it's uncomfortable. And he was talking about citizens and voters. I used it in the context of pharma. The Republicans in this administration are going to have to keep the president's word here, go where it's uncomfortable and take on, work with Democrats and take on some of these issues. And it hasn't happened yet. We're waiting. But I have to hope, for the sake of the American people, when you have 10 top-selling drugs, four of them have gone up over 100%. EpiPen, something my daughter relies on, carries everywhere because she has an allergy. You know, look what happened this summer. When these drug companies, as much as they've done some very good work, when some of them see a monopoly, they say, great, I'm going to really jack up the prices. And it's been on the backs of the American people.
You mentioned Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. Steve wants to talk to you about Iowa in a slightly different context.
You were just there.
But not with Chuck Grassley.
Not with Chuck Grassley.
All by
yourself. Not at all with Chuck Grassley.
All by yourself.
Speaking to Democrats, which, you know, everybody seems to know that Iowa is the first in the nation caucus state.
And is it?
There's some buzz
really?
About why you may have
been
there.
They're also
in
first
six
for
different
hogs.
Presidential cycles.
Remember,
yes.
They're first for hogs. We're second. Maybe third.
I want to play a soundbite from your speech in Des Moines.
Oh, no.
Clip number three. And then we'll talk a little bit about the future of the party and what you're thinking.
While there are plenty of reasons that we lost in 2016, there's at least one that we can definitely fix for next time. We can make sure that no one is left behind in where we go, in who we talk to, in what we say, and in what we do.
So My first question to you is, are you running for president? Are you thinking of running for president? What are you doing in Iowa in May of 2017 speaking to the Democratic Party?
First of all, I can see Iowa from my porch.
Right.
Okay, it is like next
where
door.
Where have I heard
Sarah
that before?
Where are you?
They asked me to come. They're Des Moines Democrats. Why? Honestly, they had a bit of a debt after a somewhat difficult election in Iowa. And I helped them, and they paid it off. And I came down there, as I've done many times. I'm going to do the Tennessee Democratic dinner, and I've done over 30 of these. So I believe that we need messengers in our party that are from other parts of the country besides the coast, as I was saying. And as a Midwesterner, I think our voice must be heard. I use the analogy in that speech of my husband being the third of six kids who grew up in a mobile home. And he was once left behind accidentally at a gas station. And we don't want to leave the Midwest behind this time as a party.
So what is the future of the party? Do you look back at 2016 and see Hillary Clinton's loss as something that was a bigger issue with the direction of the party? Or do you see it as something that maybe Hillary Clinton failed to do on her own as a candidate? And what does the party need to do moving forward?
Okay, well, there are four reasons, and we're not going to we can't really change anymore. One is the Comey letter. One is, of course, the Russian interference.
So you
and
believe
the hacking.
That those had a definitive effect?
I cannot tell you which. Let me go through them. I can only focus on the ones we can change the easiest. And that is the things that I think had the biggest effect, honestly, was one, the campaign's lack of attention to the Midwest. And that was a strategic decision, which they've admitted
and
was a
mistake.
And you
saw that in your state.
Oh, my God.
Surprisingly, yeah. Minnesota was very close.
Well, how about Wisconsin?
Can I ask you, Senator, were you raising alarms?
Yes.
Really?
In what way?
I did.
In what way?
I remember, especially with the Wisconsin, some issues with Wisconsin, I was saying, if northern Minnesota is like this, I told people that...
Tell people in the Clinton campaign.
Who did you tell in the Clinton campaign?
I'm not going to go into all those details. You guys are like, I think the books have been written on this campaign. Well, many more will come.
Many more will come.
Okay, so that is the
Midwest.
But
you sense this. You can
sense it. I could see the lawn signs. I could feel it. I'm a big lawn sign person. Okay, because I think they're real. Like
I agree with you on that.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the real things, that, which we can change in how we approach Senate races. We've got incredible candidates in the Midwest like Heidi Heitkamp and Tammy Baldwin and Claire McCaskill. And then the other thing, and Joe Donnelly, the other thing that we can change is how we talk about the issues. And that Stronger Together slogan, that was a response to Donald Trump, right? It sounds nice and the intentions were so good. But to out-of-work steelworkers in northern Minnesota, that was everyone together but me. Mm-hmm. And that's how it played out because of the whole focus on Donald Trump and what he said and then the response to that. So I think we need a clear economic message. I made an argument in Iowa about how not just the Midwest, but we need to be talking about a competitive agenda for this country where we're a country that makes stuff, invents things, exports to the world with workforce training, apprenticeships, with a low unemployment rate like we have in Minnesota. We need to acknowledge that not every kid wants to go to college and that we actually need workers that get 1 year and 2 year degrees. And the Democratic Party has to start thinking like this about what are the economic needs in our country. Immigration reform is a part of this. And then, of course, we've got economic incentives for jobs in America, and we've got infrastructure. I've got the bridge that fell down in Minnesota just 8 blocks from my house, so I can see it firsthand what had happened. And then we've got costs with health care and things we've already talked about.
I want to remind you of something you said in 2010 when the Washington Post asked you, after that election, that midterm election, which House Republicans won 63 seats and they won 6 in the Senate, in the House, it was the largest seat gain since 1948, the largest midterm gain in a non-presidential year since 1938. And the Washington Post asked you what the message was, and you said, the people of this country, and I quote you directly, want more bipartisanship. They want the government to run better. They want us to help the private sector create jobs. That was the message of this election. And we'd, I presume you meant the Democratic Party, better heed it.
Mm-hmm.
That was 6 years before the 2016 presidential election. What happened?
Are you jumping up and down enough and waving your hands?
You were saying those things not only publicly but privately. What's the disconnect? Explain there,
when
to
you
people
look
how
at,
that didn't translate
right,
or
just
resonate.
Just to step back at some of the winning races we did have in the Senate, and I'm not going to go out way off on here, but, you know, people like Catherine Cortez Masto, people like Maggie Hassan. When you look at the 2 years before that, the kind of campaign that Gene Shaheen ran or Mark Warner ran or even Al Franken ran, it was really focused on some bread and butter economic issues, these candidates. And I think we get really off when we get away from that. And people are cynical right now about institutions. Things are breaking down. They want to have actual ideas, maybe not a 100-point plan, but they want to believe that someone is going to see them where they are, and that is that they need benefits they can take with them in this gig economy. They need some flexibility at their work. They need to have a way to pay off their student loans, and that's what we should be focusing on.
Senator Klobuchar, because you're our special guest, as all of our guests, you get the last word. You know,
okay.
that's how we ended. But we've had
a great conversation.
Yes, exactly. You the summation.
But where's my food?
It's on. Well, I Senator Klobuchar, there's a lot of things I can take care of. There are a lot of things I can address. The speed and rapidity of our delivered dinner.
No.
Ask and you shall receive.
Wow, look at that bag.
Perfect
timing.
Shall receive.
Thank you.
So,
okay.
Thus concludes episode 17 of the Takeout Podcast. As you well know, dear listeners,
so my
cherished
last word
listeners,
is where's my food?
Where's your food? Exactly.
Okay, all right.
I think it's
well done.
So that means that I must return.
Oh, absolutely.
We'd love to have you back.
You always be welcome at this microphone. As you know, dear listeners, cherished listeners, new episodes of The Takeout are available every Friday morning. We invite you, really, to subscribe. The subscription rate, the higher it goes, well, the more things are possible for this humble audio odyssey. Rate and also comment on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. And also, you can find us, we are so delighted to say, on Spotify. Go to takeoutpodcast.com. We invite you to follow us and like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. We are so delighted we had our very first U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar. It's been a long time in booking this. We've been talking about this for several weeks. It finally happened.
On the biggest news week for months.
Exactly.
Perfect
As I
time.
Said,
Perfect
a bell time. Ringer, a absolute bell ringer when it comes to making news.
Is that really well done?
Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week on The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, Katiana Krachenko, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
We had a good telephone call.
We had a great call.
You guys exaggerated the call. That was a big exaggeration. I want to tell you, we had a great call. I mean, we're not babies, but we had a great call, right?
Young at heart.
We're young.
Young at heart, yeah.
We had a very, very good call. That was a little bit of fake news, as the expression goes.